Now, the next series comes under the heading of powers. And the first power notion is the notion of ability. And it involves specifying a type of behavior by means of an achievement description. The reason you have an achievement description is that just as every attitude is an attitude towards something, every ability is the ability to do something. And that something is given by the achievement description. And the pattern of occurrence is that either it does or it doesn't. It's not a frequency notion, it's a possible, impossible, or as I say, yes, no. What this yes-no pattern reflects is that if a certain behavior requires an ability you don't have, then you can't engage in that behavior. Therefore, if you think in terms of a life history, that kind of behavior will not appear anywhere. Conversely, if you have the ability, then that kind of behavior can appear in your life history. And as long as it can appear, it doesn't matter how many times it appears. If I don't know how to do arithmetic, none of the behaviors in my life history will consist of doing arithmetic. If I do know how, at least one could be. And it wouldn't matter whether I had 1, 2, 3, 10, or 50. All of those would equally well be expressions of the ability to do arithmetic. So I don't have more of the ability if I have more instances. The ability is geared to whether I can or can't do it at all. So powers notions then are ways of setting limits and of formulating the limits of what a person might or might not do. Whereas the disposition notions have to do with expectations about what a person will do. You can see then that powers or ability notions will lend themselves to both positive and negative explanations. That is, if the question is not why did he do what he did, but rather why didn't he do something that he didn't do, clearly one of the explanations will be, well, he didn't have the ability. That's why he didn't do it. Keep in mind that the problem of explaining behavior is sometimes the problem of explaining why a behavior didn't occur, not just always why a given behavior did occur. And so ability notions loom large in our negative explanations of why a person didn't do certain things. Is there any question about the notion of ability?
There could be one case. Wouldn't there, by necessity, have to be at least one case?
No. I could have the ability to do it if they can never do it at all. My having the ability connects to it being possible for me to do it, but not to my actually doing it.
A formal function like arithmetic, an operation like that, how can you make a statement about the ability unless you have a case?
Remember the separation between problems of judgment and problems of principle. Indeed, if I never did arithmetic, you might be hard put to justify saying that I knew how. But in principle, there's no difficulty that I might in fact know how, even if I never did it.
Okay, so you're contrasting knowing how.
No, I'm contrasting having the ability with exercising the ability. I'm saying, in principle, I could have it whether I ever exercised it or not. For example, I might never have the opportunity. And you can split the difference in this kind of way. You say, well, suppose that
out of a clear blue sky, I suddenly did some arithmetic. You say, well, clearly he didn't acquire the ability right now, so he must have had it already before. But if that's the first time I did it, then before that, I had never done it, and yet you're saying he must have had the ability before. So at that time, I had the ability without ever doing it. Okay, any other questions about,
yeah? Yeah, I'm sorry to put you back to this, but you said set limits. Were you referring to the limits by which the observer would evaluate, or limits as to what we can draw our information from, i.e. looking at the chart, he either has or he has got these characteristics. I don't really exactly understand what you're saying.
Well, look, contrast the task of saying what behaviors will occur from the task of saying which behaviors could and which ones couldn't.
Oh,
see, if you want to say which behaviors I couldn't do, you ask about my abilities.
Right.
If you want to say, well, what's the range of behaviors he could engage in, you ask about my abilities. Whereas if you want to bet on or predict what behaviors I will engage in, you ask about my dispositions. Not yet. Okay, now, ability clearly is a competence sort of notion. Remember, we talked about competence in connection with the know-how parameter. There we said that one refers to a learning history that prevents the performance from being accidental. So it's a competence notion. Ability is a different competence notion. If I have a given ability, it can be expected that if I try to do that sort of thing, I'll succeed. For example, if I have the ability to do arithmetic, then you can expect that if I try to do arithmetic, I'll succeed. So ability refers to a range of achievements that I could be expected to succeed at if I try. In contrast, the know-how parameter refers to a prior learning history. Those are very two different kettles of fish. One, a prior learning history. One, a range of achievements that I could be expected to succeed at. So even though they're both competence notions, they're very different competence notions. And mostly we are interested, when we're interested in competence, we're interested in ability. Sometimes we're interested in know-how, but mostly, as psychologists, we're interested in abilities. Now, as soon as you connect the notion of ability to this parameter of action, you begin to think in terms of symmetry and ask, are there other powers notions related to the other two parameters? And indeed there are. And because they're all powers notions, once you have the notion of ability, you can define the other two as special kinds of ability. So our other two powers notions, knowledge and value, we'll define as special kinds of ability. Number one, knowledge, a person's knowledge, is the range of facts that he has the ability to act on. Number two, a person's values are the set of priorities, of motivational priorities, that he has the ability to act on.
Clarify the second part of both of those things, that he has the ability to act on, why you include that as a particular delineation of the notion of values. Couldn't someone have the value, couldn't he value total racial equality and not have the power to bring that about?
Well, this definition reflects some psychological tradition. Back in the 20s and 30s, when psychologists were studying values, they started out by asking people, in effect, what do you value? And they got a lot of interesting data. At some point, they started looking at what people did, and lo and behold, they find that to a fair extent, and in many cases, people's behavior doesn't square with what they say they value. So there arose a contrast, and the contrast was between professed values, namely what you say you value, and behavioral values, which are expressed in the priorities of your choices. Now, this definition is geared to the behavioral value rather than to the professed value. Mm-hmm. So that takes care of part of it. There's another distinction that comes from the philosophical tradition, and that is between wishing and wanting. And the characteristic thing about wanting is that it goes with trying to get what you want. In contrast, and that means that what you want has to be in some sense practical, otherwise nothing will qualify as trying to get it. In contrast, wishing has no such limitation. I can wish that circles were squares. I can wish that the moon was over on the other side of the sun. See, I can wish all kinds of things. And I have the freedom in what I wish precisely because it's not connected to my trying to do anything about it. Now, a value like the one you mentioned, which is so general that it's hard to imagine anything that would really qualify as trying, I would assimilate to wishes rather than wanting. And wishing is not motivational in the sense that wanting is. So on both those grounds, that's the background of that wording.
Does wishing become a particular type of behavior, an intentional action?
If it ever does, then you can speak of it as a want.
But you can't describe a person, wouldn't a person saying, I wish such and such, wouldn't that be a type of behavior?
That's an expression of a wish.
That's your description of it.
Yeah.
Can you separate values of knowledge from ability, or is it a special case of ability?
It genuinely is a special case. It's been so long since I used a separate definition that I forget what the other one was. But it's parallel to the one for ability.
That's okay. As long as there's something that qualifies as trying, then you can try.
A person who's engaged in that sort of work, a person whose behavior that you describe as...
If you can describe the behavior as trying, then it would be meaningful to say he wanted it. But look, take something like my wishing I could jump over the moon. Is there anything you can imagine me doing, which if you saw me doing that, you'd say he's trying? There just isn't anything. So certain things, you can recognize something as an attempt. And remember, that's the function of our performative description, is to get at attempts without reference to achievements. So if it makes sense to say I'm trying, then it will make sense to say I want. And that's the distinction involved. Now, there's a little bit of legislation here, but not too much. This distinction and this way of working, it follows the kind of distinctions that have already been drawn and are part of our tradition. Any other questions about either knowledge or values?
Well,
One thing, notice that I said that the values is a set of priorities, motivational priorities. The reason is that with motivations, you're always pitting one against the other. So it's hard to deal with one motivation in isolation. You're always worrying about which is the strongest motivation, which motivation takes precedence over others. So your values do not represent absolute measures of motivation. They reflect relative motivation. And therefore, the definition is in terms of priority of one over the other. And there's no non-arbitrary way of getting absolute measures of motivation. There's certainly plenty of ways, but they're all arbitrary. In contrast, there is a quite non-arbitrary way of getting comparisons. Put me in a choice situation where I can get one thing or I can get another, and there's nothing to keep me from getting either one, but if I get one, I don't get the other. And then you see which one I pick. And that's a paradigm situation for deciding which of those two things I wanted most. So when it comes to comparatives, there's nothing arbitrary about our principles for deciding about motivation. When it comes to assigning numbers, or in some sense giving absolute measures, you can flip a coin into it. Okay, now I said that you use ability notions to set the limits of behaviors. In fact, I should have said you use powers notions, because a symmetrical argument will apply to each of these three positions. I said that if a given behavior required that you have abilities that you didn't have, then you couldn't engage in that behavior. But equally, obviously, if a given behavior requires that you have motivation that you don't have, then that's not a kind of behavior you can engage in. And if it requires that you have knowledge that you don't have, then that's a kind of behavior you can't engage in. So all three of these notions jointly are what set the limits to a person's repertoire of behaviors. Now, there's a couple of additional powers notions that I think it's more convenient to take up later in connection with the developmental schema. And these are notions of capability and liability and possibly one other. And you recognize a family resemblance between capability, liability, and ability. I guess the other one is capacity. Again, there's a strong family resemblance. All of these are, in some sense, competence or potential terms. So we'll deal with those others in connection with Maxim 8 and the developmental schema. Let's go on then to our third kind of ID characteristic. And these we call comparatives. And the two kinds of comparatives that we distinguish are states and status, or state and status. And here, too, we can do some bootstrapping, because having explained both powers and dispositions, we can now give an explicit definition of states. And the definition is this: when a person is in a particular state, there is a systematic difference in his powers and/or dispositions. When a person is in a particular state, there is a systematic difference in his powers and or disposition. Now, some of the states that we commonly distinguish are being tired, being drunk, being asleep, being unconscious, being overjoyed, being in a bad mood. These are fairly common states. Do you have a question?
Yeah, my question was, if you say there is a systematic difference, is it necessary to say what it is that difference then?
You mean what it's different from? No.
We'll get to an example. It works better that way.
Think of some of the states that I mentioned. Being tired, being drunk, being asleep, being unconscious, being exhausted, being overjoyed, being in a bad mood, being depressed, or being sick, having a headache. Now take the common one. Take being tired. Is it the case that people who are tired behave in a particular way, similar to when if a person is a hostile person, he'll behave in a particular way, namely hostile? Is there a corresponding kind of behavior that a person engages in when he's tired? I think you can see the answer is no. So being tired does not connect to behaving in a particular way. Now, what does characterize being tired? Well, suppose that we lined up 10 of you and you were all tired. And clearly you wouldn't be doing the same things. You wouldn't be behaving in the same way. And the reason that you wouldn't be behaving in the same way is that the way you behave when you're tired depends on the way that you would behave if you were not tired. And the ways that you would behave if you were not tired will not resemble each other. So if we had all 10 of you here and you weren't tired, we certainly wouldn't expect you to be doing the same things. So in general, your behavior when you were not tired would not be the same. Therefore, your behavior when you are tired won't be the same.
That's across individuals.
Right. Same with,
yeah,
look, if I'm tired and I'm doing arithmetic and then I go out and drive my car home, in both cases I'm tired, but my doing the arithmetic in no way resembles my driving the car. So again, taking the same person, when I'm tired, I don't do the same things.
I have a low frustration level when I'm tired, well, every time that I'm tired.
Yeah, but low frustration level is not a behavior. See, that's why the definition is powers and or dispositions. See, the effect of being tired is that it makes a certain kind of difference, not that it generates a particular kind of behavior. And the kind of difference it makes is most likely in your abilities. That if you're tired, you can't do some of the things that you could do if you weren't tired. Or if you can do them, you do them, but you make more errors. Or you do them, but it's harder. Or you do them, but it takes longer. Or something like that. Well, those are changes in your ability. So being tired then makes a difference primarily in your abilities. Or think of having a headache. If I have a headache, I won't be able to solve some arithmetic problems that I can solve if I don't have a headache. If I have a headache, I also can't enjoy some music that I could enjoy if I didn't have it, but neither will I be as inclined to listen to music as if I didn't have a headache. So things like headaches will make a difference not merely in my powers, but also in my dispositions and what I'm inclined to do.
That's something about the values.
Well, no, the value thing comes in that I won't enjoy it as much. if you play it and I can't help listening, I still won't enjoy it, but also I won't be inclined to turn it on. So in general, a state may affect either value or either powers or dispositions or both. Now, if you were to diagram that, what you would have is two parallel diagrams. Say, a state, you think of it in terms of pattern of occurrence. A state occupies a solid period of time. If I'm in a bad mood, I'm in a bad mood from 10:03 to 11:55, and I'm in a bad mood during the entire period. So this diagram here corresponds to the notion of a state. It occupies a solid period of time. It's characteristic of states that they're reversible. You go into them, you come out of them. So I get a headache, but then the headache goes away. I'm tired, but then I get some sleep and I'm no longer tired. I'm drunk, but then I sleep it off and then I only have a hangover. So in general, states are reversible and temporary. Now, it's because this is the usual notion of a state of reversible and temporary that we very early on introduced the notion of status to get at things of the same general sort, but which were either not reversible or not temporary. We have things like being a child. It's temporary, but it's not reversible. And so we said being a child is a status. Or think of being blind. In general, being blind is not reversible, nor is it temporary. Correspondingly, we most frequently say of a blind person that he's a blind person, rather than that he's blind right now. Because it's permanent, we associate it with the entire life history and say he's that kind of person, rather than he's in a blind state. And up until not too many years ago, being a man or being a woman was a non-reversible condition, and so those we counted as statuses. Being mentally retarded, again, by and large is not reversible. At least there are plenty of them that we haven't been able to. And there again, if we regard it as non-reversible, we say this is a mentally retarded person. If we regard it as reversible, we use other terminology like saying he's confused now, or he's sick now, or something of that sort.
I'm not sure where you make your distinction between reversible and temporary.
Well,
temporary.
No, being a child is your example. That's
temporary.
Temporary, but it's not reversible. You can't become a child again after you've grown up.
Oh, I see. So states are things that you can enter more than once.
Yeah.
That's what you mean by that.
Yeah, see, reversible and temporary. You go into them, you come out of them, but you can go into it again and come out and go in and come out.
Reversible doesn't imply that it was repeatable.
Child is the main one that we can think of that's temporary but not reversible. There are probably others that we just haven't occurred to.
Can you contrast that to status again?
A state is reversible and temporary, and in this usage, status is has the same general definition, but it's cases that are either not reversible or not temporary. Now, it turns out that that was an unfortunate move because we have a much better use for the term status. Consider it. I think that next revision of that outline, status is going to disappear and we'll simply have states and we'll distinguish temporary, reversible, et cetera, states.
Because if you look in on those two diagrams in there, if you look at that map of status dynamics, that's the kind of thing that we want to reserve the term status for. And that's a much more important sort of notion there than this relatively trivial distinction between temporary and permanent. The diagrams are in section 9, if I recall. And the status one is the second one, not the first one. And you can see that that covers a lot of ground, so. So status is an important concept, and in the future we'll reserve it for that notion rather than this one.
Is there anything violated in the logic of this notion by this comparison, except for the trivializing?
Well, at one time I thought there wasn't, and that with a little bit of explanation, you could make it do both jobs, but it's not clear to me right now that you can do it, and even if you could, I think it would still be too damn confusing. So I'd rather drop the notion of status here and simply introduce it separately the other way.
Don't you use status notion?
Well, you can distinguish reversible and irreversible states or temporary and permanent states. And that will do the job that status was doing here.
You need more states. The states are systematic kittens.
Oh, okay. The reason that the state and status are called comparatives, if you look in terms of life history, suppose this represents a period of time where I'm in a bad mood from 1005 to 1250. What's the comparison? The comparison is between how I behaved then, being in that state, and how I would have behaved if I hadn't been in that state. And we're saying there is a systematic difference between these two. But the way you understand these is by comparing it to how I would have been, and then saying I'm different in a certain way from the way I would have been. And that difference is the change in powers and or dispositions. So implicitly, you've got a comparison going here. And that's why the notion of state is characterized as a comparative notion.
Yeah, one thing about the difference between state and status seems to be that state really is more of an, a one single individual group of himself comparison, whereas status is a more social comparison.
No, you have both ways. So any given individual has a social status, and if a lot of individuals have the same status, you can say a lot of individuals are in the same state, too. You know, on a Friday night, one third of Boulder is drunk. That kind of thing. On a winter's day, half of Boulder has a cold. So there's a lot of individuals in the same state. So with social status versus this sense of state, in either case, you can have a single individual or a lot of them. And so numbers will not distinguish the two.
No, I was thinking in terms of numbers per se, so much as the comparative, you understand the concept of state by comparing the individual from one in two separate times, but you understand the status by comparing the among.
No. Matter of fact, I think you just gave the answer to Lyon's question. Do you have to know what it's different from? See, here I said, yeah, you have an implicit comparison between how I would have been acting if I weren't in a bad mood and how I do act. But think of a social status say a policeman. Who do you compare a policeman to say that he's different from in order to understand what it is to be a policeman?
Everybody else.
Well, but he doesn't differ in the same way from everybody else. Yeah. And that's why you don't have to know who a policeman is different from in order to understand about policemen.
And you couldn't understand his role without a contrast to other people not having that role. I mean, if everyone liked that, then we...
Well, yeah, but then you're simply back to the most general feature here, that everything represents a distinction between something and something else. You want to talk about policemen, you've got policemen versus anything that isn't. But that doesn't involve any comparison. Because what isn't a policeman isn't of a single kind, and there's no way to compare it with any one or even with a whole set. So as to understand policemen. Now, I said that people, when they are tired, do not behave in general the same way. Let's try setting up a series now. Suppose we say, well, consider if people are a little bit tired, and then if they're more tired, and then if they're very tired, and then if they're exhausted, and then if they're exhausted to the point of collapse. Now, as you move in this direction, you will find people behaving more and more similarly. So there are some cases where, in a given state, people's behavior will be visibly similar. And mostly those are very extreme states. And you look at it again, you say, well, maybe it's not the behavior that's so similar. What's similar is a certain gross fact about them, which isn't itself behavior, but is a fact. Namely, that the more tired people are, the more it's the case that they're not doing much of anything. And that's why they look so much alike. So that even there, maybe it's not a similarity of behavior, but rather a similarity in what they're not doing, namely, a lot of normal things. On the other hand, clearly there's a lot of visible similarity, which there isn't for when people are only slightly tired. So in some cases, then, there is a tendency for people's behavior to converge to a certain kind of behavior, whereas in others, there is simply a standard sort of difference. And it's because the difference can be of various sorts that the most specific statement you can make and still encompass this difference is this strange locution that there is a systematic difference. Talking about a systematic difference will take care of this case, but also of this case where people become more and more alike. Now, consider the limiting case over here where a person is exhausted to the point of collapse or unconsciousness. You say he's not behaving at all. But we also saw that initially, when we gave this definition that a person paradigmatically was a history of intentional action and said, we already know that a lot of time a person is not behaving. Well, this notion of states and the introduction of certain states, namely sleep, unconsciousness, etc., is what enables us now to make it all come out even. Because now we can say a person is a person who's engaging in intentional action unless he is in one of these states, which in turn can be defined by that paradigm definition. Now notice that a person who is in unconscious, etc., still has certain abilities, among which, importantly, is the ability to wake up under appropriate circumstances. So it's not as though he ceases to exist as a person because he's asleep or unconscious, etc. He still has person characteristics. What he's not doing is behaving. But his not behaving is an expression of his person characteristics at that time.
Okay, now there is an important kind of state that clinicians particularly are interested in, and that's the notion of a pathological state, which corresponds to the colloquial notion of being sick. And this is one for which we can give an explicit definition, which you won't like. The definition is this: when a person is in a pathological state, there is a significant restriction on his ability to engage in intentional action. Now, the reason people don't like this definition is there are two things that it doesn't do for you that people tend to take it for granted a definition would have to do. Number one, it doesn't tell you who's sick and who isn't. Number two, it doesn't tell you which behaviors are pathological behaviors and which aren't. On the other hand, nobody has ever succeeded in including either of those two things in a non-arbitrary way. For example, if I were to specify a kind of behavior and then say that kind of behavior is pathological, three quarters of you would disagree with me no matter what I said. Because no matter what I specified, roughly three quarters of you would disagree. And furthermore, there's no way of making a case for one sort of behavior as another if you want to specify it as pathological. That's what I mean by there is no non-arbitrary way of doing it. Furthermore, when it comes to who's sick and who isn't, there is this embarrassing thing about cultural relativity, and you can look at a person and he looks like a raving maniac, except if you put him back in his own natural milieu, he's normal. There's people who in one setting are judged to be pathological and are, in a different setting are judged not to be pathological and aren't. Because of that, there's no way of just picking out people and saying these are pathological and those are not. Now that should sound familiar. Remember I said over here, there is no one description that is simply the right description that tells you what it really is. That holds for judgments of pathology. Now, what this definition tells you is that if you have an observer or a critic who judges with respect to another person that he is in a pathological state, the observer who makes this judgment has also decided that there is a significant restriction on his intentional actions. It still leaves open who's going to judge what, but it connects these two notions and it tells you what the concept of pathology is, in contrast to judgments about who is pathological or which behaviors are pathological. Now, secondly, it introduces a notion of pathology that contrasts to two dominant other notions. The two dominant other notions are that pathology is defined in terms of a cause of behavior. That's the usual medical model. There is a cause that causes your headaches or that causes you to stumble when you walk, or in effect that causes the symptoms of your pathology. And so the pathology is identified with that cause. The other is that there are such things as pathological behaviors. And this goes with the notion that the way to cure pathology is to eliminate the pathological behaviors and replace them with non-pathological behaviors. I think the clearest way of seeing what's wrong with these, at least the pathological behavior notion, is to take a paradigm case of pathology, namely blindness. And then ask yourself, do blind people behave the same? They've got the same pathology. If you define pathology in terms of the cause, they have the same cause, so they ought to, what? Behave the same? Are the behaviors of a blind person pathological behaviors? The blind person is guaranteed to be sick, to have pathology. Does that mean then that his behaviors are pathological behaviors? Again, I think you can see the answer is no. Because the pathology shows up in what blind people don't do. What they don't do is anything that would require that they be able to see. That's where the similarity lies, in what they don't do. You see that what they don't do expresses a limitation on their possible behaviors. They can't do anything that would require that they be able to see. In contrast, what they do do reflects the resources they do have. It reflects the knowledge, motivations, and skills that they do have. And in no way would you expect those to be the same across different blind people. So the pathology then will not show up in a certain kind of behavior. And it's not very informative to go to a cause. The payoff in pathology is that there's important things that the person can't do. And it's because those things are important that we have this concept of sick. Now, this particular definition will apply equally to what is normally called physical illness and what is normally called mental illness. Yeah. See, in connection with physical illness, there is a temptation to say the sickness consists of some kind of physiological anomaly. For example, if I have a broken leg, the anomaly is that there is a physiological structure that is damaged. And you say, well, if you can point to that kind of thing, that's the real pathology. Now, imagine a hypothetical situation where a person with a broken leg would be able to run, jump, hop, kick people, play football, climb stairs, and do everything that a person could do if he didn't have a broken leg. Do you suppose that under those conditions we would count broken legs as sickness? Hell no. Now, you can point to plenty of physiological abnormalities that have no behavioral counterparts. For example, if you examine the hairs on my arm, you might find that they were twisted a little relative to the norm. And that's a perfectly straightforward, identifiable physiological abnormality. Since it doesn't make any difference in what I can or can't do, we don't count that as being sick. So even with physical illnesses, the mark of it being an illness is that it prevents us from doing important things. And the more important they are, the more surely we will call it an illness. The less important, the less we're going to call it an illness. Now, when it comes to things preventing me from doing important things, if I have a broken leg and can't go to work, that's important. But if I'm so caught up in either envying my employer or competing with my fellow employees that I can't do my job and I get fired, that's important too. So, emotional conflicts can generate important restrictions on your ability to engage in actions just as surely as physiological anomalies. But it's the restriction on your possible actions that is the crucial thing. And that's what we think of when we think of illness. Yeah.
In reference to the medical model, in the way of physical illnesses, you can see more of a rationale for talking of them with, you know, defined in terms of or in reference to their causes. So are you kind of quite understanding what your implications are for that?
Keep in mind the cause of an illness is different from the illness itself. And as long as you can identify causes of particular illnesses, there's no reason why you shouldn't. In fact, it has the value that I described for cause-effect descriptions. What's confusing is if you mistake the cause for the thing itself. You mistake the cause for the illness. Keep in mind that you could easily have the same illness with different causes, and that unless you define the illness in terms of the cause, it is the same illness.
This notion generates two almost necessary qualities for ambiguities. And the first one would be that, say you got a character who most people would say is crazy, you know, does crazy things, but also can do everything else that would be expected of a person. That person is sort of difficult to, you know, the notion of what you mean by crazy then in terms of pathology becomes sort of strange. And the other ambiguity we deal with, if you're talking about state, pathological state in terms of time period in which the person is engaged in certain behaviors, then it seems that this is to say that while the person is engaging in behavior X, he can't engage in behavior A, B, and C.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is while I type on my typewriter, I also can't do certain other things.
Yeah, but you don't lose your ability to do those other things. Remember, the significant restriction on ability.
Well,
the emphasis on the connection with traits. I said, how much hostile behavior is enough? And I said, enough. Well, how much of a restriction does it take in order for you to say that he's sick? And the answer is the same, namely enough. That's why the specification is simply a significant restriction. And different observers will differ in what they will count as significant enough. So the definition is content-free. It is a formula-type definition. It leaves open to particular observers making particular judgments as to which people they are going to count as pathological. This merely explicates what notion it is they're using when they call somebody pathological. The same way, for example, I could draw you a picture of a house and then say, different observers will differ as to which things they count as houses. And indeed, that will be the case. Then I can say, but when a person calls something a house, here is what he's calling it. This is what he has in mind. So again, separate conceptualization from judgment. Conceptualization gets at what it is that's being said. Judgment gets at which things have the feature. I think that probably danger is one of the best cases for making that separation. Consider the notion of may be injurious to your health. And then consider each of our individual judgments about which things may be injurious to our health. We will differ in which things we will count as injurious to our health. But we'll be using the same concept, namely injurious to our health. So which things you identify as being instances of the concept will differ from one person to another, but you can have all of them using exactly the same concept. Okay, now, in connection with the concept of pathological state, there is another important concept that we can also give a definition, and that's the concept of need. And here's the definition. A need is a condition which, if not met, results in pathology. Now, that's a fairly straightforward definition. It simply reflects the fact that people do get into pathological states under certain conditions and not others. Whatever knowledge you have about the conditions under which they do, you formulate in terms of need. You can say, for example, that people need water. Why? Because keep you away from water for a few days and you darn well are in a pathological state. Or people say, people need self-esteem. Why? Well, take away all your self-esteem and ask yourself what kind of potential for action you'd have, and the answer is zero. That's a very significant restriction. Or somebody says, a basic human need is the need for order and meaning. Try imagining your potential for behavior if your world contained no order or meaning. Again, it would be zero. So the limiting case of a significant restriction on your ability to engage in intentional action is a condition under which you couldn't engage in action at all. And those will be basic human needs, like order and meaning, self-esteem, etc. If you have none of those, you have zero behavior potential, so you have a complete restriction. It's only a partial description, then it's not a basic human need, it's just a need. Now you can see why the concept of need would be important for people who deal with pathology. Clearly, you'd be interested in how it came about, what condition was not met, because one of the most obvious guidelines for how to cure the person is to make good that need, to furnish exactly what it was that he wasn't getting that resulted in the pathology. Okay, I think that pretty well finishes what I want to say right now about personal characteristics, except maybe for one overall warning. We've discussed 4, 3, and 1. We've discussed 8 personal characteristic notions. Keep in mind that these are just categorizations. The notion of a trait, for example, people do not just have traits. They always have particular traits. So under each heading, there is an unlimited number of particulars of that kind. Under the heading of trait, there's an unlimited number of particular traits. Under the heading of attitude, there's an unlimited number of particular attitudes. Under the heading of ability, there's an unlimited number of possible abilities. And what distinguishes them, remember, a type of behavior and a pattern of occurrence. It's the type of behavior that will distinguish one trait from another, one attitude from another, one ability from another.
From your presentation, it seems that needs would not differ from person to person in terms of basic needs, just in terms of relative amounts.
Right, that's why they're called basic human needs. And the things that are basic human needs tie into the notion of action, any condition that would make intentional action impossible is clearly going to be universal and therefore will qualify as a basic human need. See, in contrast, if you say of me that unless I get that job that I've applied for, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown, that's not a need that other people have, but you might say, I have it. So some needs are universal, others are particular, some are sort of in between. Okay, any questions about any of this material on individual difference characteristics?
Going back to introduce the concept of limitation of culture, in a specific culture, impossible that a particular behavior is termed pathological. That's the another culture is not.
Well, not in terms of this definition, because here you don't term any behavior pathological. It's the person who is in a pathological state.
Okay, the person in a pathological state. You define that as pathological state is a significant description and his ability to engage in intentional action.
Yeah. Let me add something here that may be relevant if you're talking about cultural differences. There is an equivalent definition of pathology. And that is that when a person is in a pathological state, there is a significant restriction on his ability to participate in existing social practices. And the two are equivalent.
Can you tell me? No, that was my answer.
There is a significant restriction on his ability to participate in existing social practices. And it's because social practices differ from one culture to another that you may be able to in one and not able to in another, and therefore be pathological from one point of view and not from the other.
It seems like in your explanation of the need that you just gave a really good justification for the therapist as teacher sometimes.
Yeah. Remember that there was no restriction on the content of the need. Simply said, any condition which, if not met, results in pathology. Now, clearly, it's possible that the condition that wasn't met was that the person should have learned something. In that case, if you follow that line of reasoning, you simply teach him what he never learned. And the therapist is teaching.
What are the implications if you posit the need as some finite quantity? In other words, something that there's not enough of to go around. For example, that job that you want. Okay, what if two people want that job, both need it, and will have a nervous breakdown if they don't get it? What implications does that have for therapy for the one who didn't get it?
Well, cheer up, there's hope. I said that the most obvious line to curing somebody who's sick is to investigate the condition which was not met and make it good. However, if you think of that definition again, think of that definition, that's not the only way to go. See, you might not touch that condition that led to his pathology, but instead concentrate on giving him new behavior potential such that when you add that to what he already had, he's no longer significantly restricted.
But that the other thing ceases to be a need.
Yeah, that's right. See, and to put it in the concrete terms you did, you retrain the person to make him eligible for some other job. So you don't always have to attack what you consider the cause of the pathology in order to cure the person.